Okay, let's see if we can get the show on the road here. Let's see, how many people here are in the environmental health section of this group? Okay, let me try a different way. How many aren't? Oh, cool, welcome. And then for those of you who have done climate change stuff, how many, if you've been to one session, raise one hand. If you've been to two, raise two. If you've been to a lot, stand up. Cool. Okay. All right. Well, you got to start out. Well, there's some really good news here. For those of you who are Cubs fans, we almost made it this year. We're all in Chicago, and I'm from Chicago, so it was I didn't expect them to get as far as they did, but they got really far, and that was spectacular. But even better good news is, of course, that they just decided to theme the 2017 APHA conference on climate change. So all you guys. All of you have been working on this for years. I think you really do get a great kudos, and the impact of that, just being able to announce it and talk about it and get ready for it over the next couple of years, is huge. And I got to tell you, there's other parts of society that are going that same way. My name is Bob Perkowitz. I'm from an organization called Eco America. My background has been in the corporate world. My marquee value is in marketing. I got involved in the climate stuff mainly through my wife, who was president of the Sierra Club. I've been on the board of the Sierra Club, on the board of Environmental Defense Fund, and started Eco America about 8 years ago to do large-scale public engagement on climate. You have to get the message and messenger right, but really what you want to do is change, hi John, institutions and infrastructure. So that's what we work on at Eco America. We've done some very large programs like the American College and University President's Climate Commitment, which has 700 colleges and universities right now that have committed to going climate neutral, and a variety of other stuff, but I don't want to talk about that. The whole session here is about health in all policies and in all sectors. And this is the session where we pull that together. We have somebody here from higher education, from business, from faith, and then from health here to show you about the impact of climate and health in their sectors. We are all in this together. Health can't solve it by themselves, and faith can't, but if we all work together, we can. It's very interesting when you talk to the people, let's say in faith, that they talk about stewardship and creation care and moral justice and things like that. And if you talk about the business people, they're talking about risk and opportunity. And if you talk about communities, they're talking about resilience. But all of them talk about health. Health is in everything that everybody does. You are the one thing. Only certain of us are going to higher education. Certain of us work in corporate America. But everybody in America cares about their health. And you guys are the most trusted professionals of any sector in America. So you guys, your impact can be huge on climate change. We've got an hour and a half for the presentation here. As you see, I talk rather quickly. My goal is to let these guys talk and to let... make sure there's enough time so we can be very participative about this conversation. I think it's going to be, we've got some great speakers, and it's going to be a great opportunity to hear some other perspectives. And so I want to make sure we have time to share that. My role here is to introduce people and then to provide a little bit of context. And so that's what I'm going to do, is start with just a little bit of context. And these slides go by quickly. Obviously, the impacts of climate change, every week there's a record something going on. This week it's that Oman is going to flood. The desert's going to flood with an all-time epic storm. And it's all around us. What used to be 2030, 2050, 2100 is 2013, 2015, and 2020 right now. And all those physical impacts affect our health, and they affect it in a variety of different ways. There is the physical health, there is the mental health, and then there's the impact on our society. And if you ignore any one part of that, you're missing a big part of the picture, because all three of those things interact with each other, which is why it's the arc. I think all these slides are going to be available online. If they're not, you can ping us and we'll get them to you. The biggest challenge that we have is that Americans are not paying attention to climate change. Right now in America, only 3% of Americans say that they talk about climate change regularly or often. 73% of Americans say they talk about climate change rarely or never. And then the remaining 23-24% say they talk about it occasionally. It's kind of a subject that if you're in the bubble of climate change, you talk about it all the time. But if you go down to Indianapolis, Indiana, and apologies for if I'm disparaging, you know, my niece goes to school down there, and I'm going to be down there next weekend. You know, if you talk about climate change, it's really most people are not comfortable. They don't know enough about it. It's a political issue. They don't talk about it. So it's hard to solve a problem that you can't really talk about. Four reasons why people don't talk about climate change in America. On the left, the row of words is what we call motivated avoidance, the psychological reasons. They don't want negative information. They don't want conflict. A lot of people think that we are just going to solve it because if you can go out and start a limousine scheduling service and have that worth $50 billion 5 years later, you can do pretty much anything, right? So there's a techno-optimism thing. But the other bigger thing is that climate change has become a politicized issue, and whether or not you're on one side or the other side, you have the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Wall Street Journal on your side and Fox News, or you've got other institutions like the American Public. We all have institutions that support our views, so you can be comfortable hiding in your own perspective on climate change. And perhaps the biggest problem that we have is that of the 15 largest companies in the world, 13 of them are fossil fuel companies. One company, Royal Dutch Shell, did $494 billion in revenue in 1 year. Those 13 companies together did $3 trillion worth of revenue last year. So we've got these large forces of things that are kind of like standing in our way. And the good news now, and you couldn't have said this 5 years ago, is that we have solutions all over the place. In the upper left is a graph of utility scale electricity being installed globally. And as you can see, if you go back 10 years ago, it was 80% fossil fuels and 20% renewable energy. In 2013, those things crossed, and this year it'll be about 72 or 73% of all the electricity installed globally will come from renewable sources, and that doesn't include nuclear. On the upper right, policies. Do we have policies that will work? We have three grand policy experiments in North America. We have in British Columbia, in the Northeast states, the Reggie states, and now in California, they have all enacted either a carbon tax or a cap and trade system to reduce emissions. All three of them, within 5 years of when the policy announces, end up reducing their carbon intensity by 20% or more while their economy grows faster than the other provinces or the other states around them that don't have a carbon policy. So we have the technology solutions, we have the policy solutions, and right now, especially leading up to Paris in 5 weeks or so, we have businesses, governments, cities all over the world are making announcements. There's a group of corporations right now, there are about 40 of them, which include Walmart, Starbucks, Nike, Goldman Sachs. 40 huge corporations have all committed now to going 100% climate neutral. And then, of course, everybody's making their individually determined national commitments to climate change in different places around the world. And then we have the big guy. The Pope is on our side. And Obama is making it a legacy issue. So there's a lot of momentum all over the place on climate change. And where are the American people? Well, this is going back to 2008 this University of Michigan on how many people think that that climate change is real. We are at all-time record low in denial at 16%, and then we are, for the last 4 or 5 years, we've been steadily climbing up, and we are accelerating now on people who are aware of and concerned about climate change. So there's a lot of forward momentum. And here in health, you know, any major health association, especially in public health, has got pages and pages of stuff about health and climate change out there. There's a lot of information, and in particular with the APHA right now, if you go to their homepage and it says issues, the number one issue is climate change, and you scroll to that, and it goes to a program called Climate and Health, which is the program we have been working on with the APHA for a while. You look at this conference, these are all the sessions that are on climate change. I don't know, I mean, that's for every possible thing about health and climate, there's a session on it here. So what we do, and the reason why I'm here, is that our goal is to make climate change a mainstream issue. All issues start as special interest issues, like gay rights. It's about them, and then they turn into public interest. They turn into personally relevant public interest. And that's what we're trying to do with climate change, is make it personally relevant to people. So we have five different programs for faith, higher education, health, and communities, and business that help them address climate change, get the resources that they need. And then we're building leadership groups and getting them on what we call a path to a positive energy future. Just want to point out, we ground in a lot of research. We do values research, communications research, academic research, all for free on our website. If you want to know how to talk about climate change or what Americans think, you can go there. The two reports in the front here on the left is one we partnered with the American Psychological Association, and we did a report on the psychological impacts of climate change, which I think are not fully understood or developed yet. And then on the one on the right, it is amazing how little funding goes into health. Health is the second most funded thing in America, and very little of that money goes into climate. So the guide on the right, we partnered with the Health and Environmental Funders Network to produce a guide for funders and for NGOs that seek funding to advance climate and health. And again, all these reports are available on our website for free. But the main thing we're doing in the Climate for Health program is we're engaging a lot of national institutions, the CEOs of them and the organizations themselves, to embed climate and elevate it in their mission. And so these are people that we are working with already. And then we ask them to commit to a vision of a positive future, to some principles of justice, of health, of prosperity, and then the commitment to reduce their emissions and engage their stakeholders. This is the Climate for Health website. There's four sections of it. The one on the left is talking points. If you want to talk, it's amazing how many people don't talk about climate change because they're just uncomfortable talking about it. The second thing is how they make an impact, reduce their emissions. The third section is how they engage others. If you're in a hospital, what do you do? Green teams, your policies, your HR manuals. And then the fourth section, Connect and Share, has daily news and updates about everything that's going on in climate and health. So that's it for me. And now I'm going to just tell you who we have up here on the stage. First, Samantha Hoot is a pediatrician. She works at Nova, and she has in a private practice in Alexandria, Virginia. And she has done as much on pediatrics and climate as anyone, maybe more. Ben Lowe, here, immediately here, is with the Evangelical Environmental Network. He's their national spokesman, leaning toward the younger side of the Evangelical Network. Sarah Wachos is the co-legislative director of an organization called the Environmental Law and Policy Center here in D.C. She is going to be talking about the business perspective. And then anybody here who doesn't know Howie Frumkin, I don't know how that could possibly happen. Howie is, since his years at the CDC, has been a true national leader in public health and climate. He set it up. So I'm going to start this whole thing, and we're going to start with Samantha. They're going to talk for 10 to 15 minutes each. Depending upon the flow, we may ask them a question at the end of the session, but mainly we're going to try to leave a half hour at the end so that you guys can all, we can all talk. So, Samantha, will you talk to us?
It's somewhat ironic, perhaps, that maybe the youngest person on the panel doesn't have a PowerPoint. I was introduced as a national spokesperson for the Evangelical Environmental Network. I'm more accurately the national spokesperson for Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, which is part of the Evangelical Environmental Network. But perhaps even more accurately, I used to be the national spokesperson for YECA. In order to be considered young, you have to be 30 years old and under. And I had a 31st birthday recently. And so now I'm a senior advisor for Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. And I had to turn my responsibilities over to someone who I think will do a really good job. But they invited me to go out and start middle-aged evangelicals for climate action, and I decided I'd just be a senior advisor instead. Thank you for having me here. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for your presentations. One of the leading and most respected environmentalists of today, Gus Speth, He was the first advisor to a U.S. president on climate change, and he was for many years the dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Met with a group of evangelical leaders and pastors a number of years ago. I'm not sure if that's the meeting we were just talking about that you were at. Okay, it might have been, so you can see how close I get this quote right. But convinced to speak to a group of Christian leaders, he said something pretty close to the following. He said, when I first started in this work, and when he says that, he means, you know, it's been quite a while. He said, I thought the main threats to the planet today were things like biodiversity loss and pollution and climate change. And he said, but then I realize now that I'm wrong. The main threats to the planet today are things like greed and apathy and pride. And as scientists, we don't always have the solution to those problems. Maybe it's time for us to work with people of faith to bring those solutions along. I think he was right. And as a Christian who works for a group called the Evangelical Environmental Network, I hope you bear with me because a lot of my comments are going to come from a more Christian perspective, although a lot of it is very relevant no matter what faith background or affiliation you identify with. But as a Christian, I hear something like that from Gus Speth, and I think that's prophetic in many ways. He's saying that the problems that we're facing today aren't just political problems, they aren't just scientific problems, they're also moral problems. And if we don't address them as moral problems, then we will not, at the end of the day, find the full solution, the most effective solution. Now, I have an admission to make, but it's not a surprise to any of you. A lot of you probably realize that people of faith, and particularly the evangelical Christians, haven't always been very good at these issues, haven't always been very good at science in general, and that comes to a lot of things like creation and evolution and all sorts of other fun stuff. But we also haven't been particularly good about climate change. And a lot of our community identifies as politically conservative and politically Republican. And boy, they aren't doing so great on this all the time either. I actually know a lot of Republicans, and some Republicans in office who are really good on this, but they're not sure how much it will cost them to speak up at the moment. So don't give up on them yet, and don't give up on us yet. But while Christians haven't always been known as leaders on this issue, I think in a lot of people think these days that that's somewhat of a tragedy because we should be and we can be. Really, when you look into the scriptures that we claim to hold very close, there is a lot that the Bible has to say about our responsibility to be caretakers, to be stewards of God's creation. The greatest commandment, when Jesus was asked what's the most important thing in the world, he said it this way. He said, the most important commandment is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like the first, to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, you don't have to be a Christian to think, all right, how are you going to love God fully and faithfully if you don't care for the world that he made and that he has entrusted into our stewardship? And the second is like the first. How are we going to love our neighbors, especially our children, fully if we don't address environmental degradation and climate change, which is affecting many, in particular those who a lot of folks call the least of these, those struggling with poverty around the world? We can't do it. And I could go on and on. I could talk about how the Bible gives us a very strong foundation and ethic for valuing creation, valuing nature and the environment, how it gives us a very strong ethic for the role that humans can play as compassionate stewards over the environment. And I could go on and on about the role that the Bible gives us that shares with us about what God is doing in the world and what God's vision for the world is and how we're called to be part of that. So I believe that Christians and evangelicals should be leaders in this, and as far as we haven't been, I'm sorry. We've been missing the boat. And I'm really grateful for groups like Eco America and Sierra Club and many others who have been bringing the leadership to the table when we have been missing. We owe them a lot of thanks and a lot of gratitude, and there's a lot that we can learn from these groups. But I want to share a little bit about what we are doing, because things are changing. And the Pope's encyclical highlighted it and brought a lot of publicity to it. I'm really grateful for that. And I tell you, if the evangelicals had a Pope, we'd probably just go and make him our Pope too. We really like him and a lot of what he's about. The Evangelical Environmental Network, though, has been around for over 20 years. And it's just one of many groups working in the faith community and in the Christian community in specific. And what the Pope said in the encyclical really echoes a lot of what many evangelical leaders have said over time. And we're getting louder and we're getting more effective. But EEN has a dual mission. On one hand, we're about education and raising awareness. And on the other hand, we're about advocacy and mobilizing those Christians that we engage and having them raise their voices to call for collective and political change. We do have a more strategic focus on conservatives because as evangelicals, we can speak very effectively to our fellow evangelicals in ways that many other people can't. And whatever your faith background is, you'll understand too that as a person of a particular faith, you will be able to speak most effectively to the people in your faith community as well. And so that's where we've chosen to focus, engaging with evangelicals and engaging with the conservatives in the evangelical community. We believe that the message is important, but so is the messenger. And that's what we're really trying to get right, both the message and the messenger. A lot of our community is not convinced by science, and we've got tons of polling data to back that up. Science is not what convinces people. I believe science is extremely important. My education is in science. I hope to pursue further education, maybe at the University of Washington, in science. But I recognize at the same time that my faith community isn't particularly always convinced by science, as a lot of America isn't always convinced by the science. But there are other things that we can use to bridge this issue for our community and for other faith communities. And health is a really big one. So that's why I'm glad to be here. I want to share four big areas of focus that we have and give you an example of the work that we do in each four, and then I'll turn it over to the next speaker. But the first is on human life and children's health in particular. A lot of evangelicals are known, or the evangelical community in general is known as being pro-life. Now, I know a lot of evangelicals that aren't pro-life, and I know a lot of evangelicals that nuance what it means to be pro-life. And I know that often the issue of whether you're pro-life or pro-choice comes down to the very, very challenging and painful issue of abortion. I don't want to talk about that here. I know you don't either. But what I want to talk about, and this is what we talk about to our community, is if you're really going to be consistently pro-life, then it's not just about caring for developing babies in the womb. It's also caring for the person once they're born for the rest of their life. You know, you can't be pro-life if you're not whole life. And a few years back, some of you might have been aware, the EPA was working out its MATS rule, mercury and air toxics rule. And a lot of it was about addressing mercury pollution, which the majority of the mercury pollution in this country comes from coal-fired power plants. And I remember hearing 1 out of every 6, and I don't have this source here, so let's just take that lightly. But a lot of babies in the U.S. are born with unsafe levels of mercury in their system at birth. So for Christians, this really should be a pro-life issue. And we worked very effectively with a lot of conservatives and a lot of conservative political leaders and elected officials to frame it as a pro-life issue and to help defend the rule, which was ultimately successful. We also look at clean energy in the same lens, about how pollution affects a lot of people's health, and particularly the people who live around coal-fired power plants. I lived in Chicago. I'm in the suburbs now, but I lived in Chicago for a couple years, and I lived in the neighborhood of Pilsen, which is just up the street from one of the more polluting coal-fired power plants in the whole region, which has since been shut. But a lot of my neighbors know that clean energy and energy is a health issue and is a life issue. Just a few weeks ago, we held an event with Senator Casey, the senator from Pennsylvania. And while he's a Democrat, he is also a pro-life senator, and he's a senator from a coal state. So this climate change issue and energy is a tough issue for him. But we held an event with him at Eastern University, which is an evangelical school, along with, on the panel with us, was a representative from the Catholic Church, which is his faith community, and a representative from Moms Clean Air Force, which maybe some of you are familiar with. And we talked about climate change and energy as an issue of human health. And the senator at that event came out in public to support the president's, to support the Clean Power Plan, which was the first time he had done that in public. So that's some of the work that we do there. The second area I'd like to highlight is around justice, poverty, and relief and development. This is really a big deal for the church. We have a lot of relief and development organizations and a lot of organizations working to address poverty in this country and around the world. And we work very closely with those groups and organizations. A few years back, we actually led a trip to Malawi in partnership with the Evangelical Church in Malawi. We brought a group of religious leaders from this country over there to learn from the church in Malawi, which is taking a much more active stance on climate change, and to see, to visit villages on the ground and see the, first of all, the impacts of what climate change is having on people trying to farm and people trying to live and people trying to address poverty, but also to see the good news of how creatively communities are coming together to overcome some of these new challenges and the changes that they are facing. That was a really effective trip. We also work to support the Green Climate Fund. We work on international adaptation funding and a number of other issues that address justice and poverty and relief and development. The third area that I want to address is climate disasters and relief. And we have a partnership with the Humanitarian Disaster Institute, which is based out of Wheaton College, an evangelical institution in the suburbs of Chicago, around what we're calling the Joseph Pledge, which is a recognition that disasters are growing and changing, and as Christians, we should be like the biblical character of Joseph, who was given a vision of impending disaster and worked with his country and his community to prepare them to face up to that disaster faithfully. And the last thing I would like to mention is the generational role that YECA, groups like Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, have to play here. We're doing a lot of work around the country to lift up young evangelical voices in particular and to remind folks, political leaders and church leaders, that this is the earth that we are about to inherit, and inheritances are supposed to be a blessing. So thank you for the work that you are doing on all of these fronts. Thank you for those of you who have been engaging in the faith community for a long time. I hope you will continue to be patient with us as we grow and improve. And I want to leave you with one, what I find a very encouraging update, which is that just about a week ago now, the National Association of Evangelicals, which is the leading evangelical network around the country, they represent over 40 denominations, millions of evangelical Christians, and thousands of churches. They finally, after many years of engaging around this issue, their board met and they took a very strong position. They passed a resolution saying that addressing climate change is part of the mission of the church today. Thank you.
He's asking how you can best invest, advance, divest, invest.
Do we need the microphone? Can you hear me if I just speak like this?
I don't hear you. You won't be recorded, I don't think.
Let's kind of all slide down one chair and we'll pass the microphone. This is as far as it goes, but I think if you guys all move down one, you can get there.
Well, thanks for the question, Jonathan. For those who couldn't hear the question, was kind of the advanced investment campaigns on campuses. I think student activism and pressure are really effective, and I think also from the point of view of regents and other fiduciary bodies who care about the bottom line for university holdings, showing them that this is an economically viable thing to do is really important. And that in turn depends on the economic viability of portfolios that don't include fossil fuels. So we need more and more to support the development of economic solid ground for companies other than the fossil fuel sector, and to demonstrate that that's a sensible way to invest. By the way, we need more and more investment advisors and portfolio managers who know how to work with divested portfolios. That's a pretty rare skill set. This is like looking for a builder to rebuild a green building. So that's, I hope, a skill set that we'll see growing over time.
Thank you, Professor, and thank you, Professor John.
No, about something I need to thank you for four wonderful, different thought-provoking talks. Really great panel. I had a question for Dr. Adu. Thank you for the work that you did putting together these really great policy statements of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Here at APHA, we have some pediatricians, but we have a really big maternal child health section. And I don't know what happened at 6:30 this morning. We didn't have an intersectoral meeting. I'm sure that there may be more people from maternal child health, but I'm not sure just how energized the world of maternal and child health is about climate change. So any thoughts on, you know, in terms of the AAP policy or just your broader experience, how to make inroads in the child health community?
Sure, I agree that there has not been a lot of awareness among physicians generally and pediatricians specifically about climate change and its influence on child health. I think it's something that one of the main I think education of physicians is a big priority right now. And within the American Academy of Pediatrics, there is a lot of momentum, especially coming with the new policy statement around that, to increase awareness within our chapters, within the districts. And there's active work also with ECO America. We're partnering now with ECO America. And there's work to try to raise this issue within the academy. So I am pretty optimistic that it's coming. Things move very slowly. I've learned within the academy, but I think it is coming. I know that within INOVA, where I practice, we now have a sustainability director. Now we have I have a new appointment. I'm the climate and health physician liaison. You know, they're giving me leeway to speak for them. I'm doing presentations within the medical school and for the residents. So I think that it's gaining momentum, but I absolutely agree that it's not there yet. And I think that education of physicians is a big component. I mean, most of us practice with our individual patients every day, and we're not thinking so much about what's coming before, you know, and we have to make that leap to the social determinants of our individual patient's health, including climate change.
Okay, let's do you and then you.
Good afternoon. Thank you again for a wonderful panel. My name is Asante Schill. I'm from the New York State Health Department in the Office of Public Health Practice. And I'm the coordinator for one of our climate and health programs. And my question is for the young environmental evangelicals, the network. What would you recommend as effective strategies for us in the government to outreach the faith-based community?
Thank you, Sante. That's a great question. We do work quite a bit with different parts of the government. A lot of it's out of Washington, D.C., but you can just send me an email if you'd like, and we'd be glad to start a conversation. We work a lot with the Office of Faith and Neighborhood Partnerships. They have different satellite offices and all the different agencies in D.C., for instance. Does that answer your question?
Steve Ferrati with the Bethel County Health Department in Illinois. And this can go to anybody on the panel. Interested to know if anybody has done any research or has perhaps any opinions on alternative technologies used for solid waste management. And when I think about that, what I'm thinking in particular are plants that are around the nation and across seas that will utilize a high temp burn produced steam to run turbine generators.
Okay, let's see if this will make it over there. I have a thought on that too. But.
So that's a great question. Obviously, solid waste is a problem that we all have to deal with as consumers and as citizens. There's a couple of things, and I want to get to your technology in a second, but you know, more sustainable ways to deal with waste are obviously composting and recycling, and then there's methane digestion for organic waste, which takes, you know, traps the methane and uses it, burns it, and uses it to create electricity. There are a lot of technologies out there. One's called pyrolysis, one's called plasma arc, that take waste, mostly plastics, because you take all the rest of the stuff out of it, and at very high temperatures, either heat it up, or in the case of pyrolysis, you're actually like grinding it in a very slow manner. The problem is that there is still some toxins that are released as a part of that process, and so I think we just need to think very, very carefully on what the pros and cons are. In particular, the dioxins, I think, are still released during those processes. So they're very expensive as well, very, very expensive, and landfills, we still have space, so I think that in the United States, at least, we have not jumped on that ship yet, but I could see in the future that issue coming up a lot more.
Let me just say, do you know healthcare without harm, don't you? Have you heard of that organization? If you're into the physical plant, reducing your energy use, reducing your toxins, and you're anywhere in the healthcare sector, there's an organization called Healthcare Without Harm, which is the dominant, by far, the only player in the field, and they do a spectacular job of helping people and help green their institutions. So there's a lot of potential for business and health faith and health, higher education and health, to partner to move climate solutions forward. And we've got just a few minutes left, and so I just wanted to ask the panel, and Howie, if you want to get to your other question, you can do it as part of your thing. I just want to ask you that if there's one thing that you think of that in your sector, be it faith or any of the sectors, one thing that you could do that would further the partnership between health and that sector to advance climate solutions, what would you do? Go, Ben.
Oh, gee. I would say just being able to partner with specific leaders in the health community, like Howard, who was part of that group of evangelical leaders and scientific leaders who met a number of years ago. That's really fruitful stuff, because you bring the expertise and the credibility to the table, and then we can bring our communities and we can find common ground and work together. But those personal relationships and partnerships would be probably where I would start.
I would like the AAP to adopt as one of its priorities, so that just like the APHA is now, is going to be main topics, I guess, for 2017. If we did that, then we could talk about it. It would be a focus of discussion at our annual meeting, and it would become a lot that much easier for pediatricians to talk about it with our families and highlight the issue. So I hope that happens.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about an opportunity for faith and health connections. I'm probably not the only person in the room who feels heartbroken most days these days when I read about the refugee crisis in Europe. I think that's probably a harbinger of things to come as large parts of the world become uninhabitable and more people are displaced by climate change. I think there's a phenomenal opportunity there for public health and faith communities to get together. Intrinsic to our thinking is identifying vulnerable populations and serving them. Intrinsic to the faith community is welcoming the stranger. I think we're on the same page there. And I think that if we translate that into active work on immigration policy and on humane acceptance of refugees in adequate numbers, that's something we need to be doing as a world, and it's a great chance for us to build those bridges. I can't think of a more pressing issue today than that.
Amen.
So I think what we need to do for business, I think this is starting to get to be done, but it needs to do better to better quantify the risks and rewards to the bottom lines. I mentioned that the productivity obviously affects GDP. GDP affects health care access. All those things together affect business bottom line, and I think that we're starting to see more of the risk. We really do have to quantify the reward as well. Not only in if we mitigate getting not realizing some of the catastrophic result of climate change, but also there's going to be winners in this, and business is going to take advantage of that. And the winners are going to be the ones that are doing the innovation and taking advantage of the space that we open up for clean energy technologies. And I think we just need to, people are digging in, certainly, but we need to do a better job of having some economics out there to show people that.
I'm going to, we've got 5 minutes left, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to end this 5 minutes early so we can all have a little bit more of a break. I want to again thank all the panelists for being so wonderful. I want to thank you for coming. If there's if there's one thing that I can suggest that you do, that there is a lot of learning in the health sector from a lot of different organizations on climate and health, and spreading the word is the most important thing that you can do. So if you can get to the Climate for Health website and get talking points, if you can get it embedded in your hospitals and institutions, the main thing to do is talk about, get people engaged, and if we can do that, we can solve all the other problems. So thanks so much, and have a good rest of your conference, and see you in 2017.